This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, a conundrum for businesses and their employees. In some cases, it's a better financial deal to continue drawing unemployment benefits. We'll hear about that. Also, reopening the economy will mean a lot of big decisions fall on state and local officials. We'll learn about a task force that will provide some guidance. A key way to ramp up COVID-19 testing is to have the test self-administered.
People can test themselves on a regular basis, and you don't need staff or people to wear PPE to do the collecting. You don't need them to be there. If you could just hand people a sample or they could pick up a kit.
But what are the drawbacks? That and more this hour. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family as the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, we've heard how urban hospitals are battling COVID-19, but what about those in rural areas? What challenges are they facing? We'll have that report. Getting customers back to reopen businesses is just part of the problem. Some employers are finding it difficult to get workers back on the job. And we'll hear about a group of experts working to guide the state and local officials as they make decisions in the coming months. That and more ahead on Statewide. Since the start of the pandemic, grocery store aisles have been crowded and shelves emptied of basic food items. To avoid the mayhem, some shoppers are turning to smaller markets in more rural areas. And as Dana Cronin with Harvest Public Media reports, that's giving rural grocery stores a boost.
Winchester, Illinois is a town of fewer than 2,000 people. Great Scott Community Market opened in an old shoe store there less than a year ago. Before then, the nearest grocery store was about 20 miles away.
Where a previous owner sold shoes, we've got our dried goods and canned goods and all the grocery staples that you'll find in any grocery store.
Market President John Paul Coonrod says they also sell your standard craft beer, wine, and frozen foods and have a deli section in back. Since the pandemic started, he says business has been booming with sales through the roof for the first 10 days.
After that, we've settled into a pretty good stasis of sales that are about double, I would say, what they were pre-COVID.
Coonrod says he usually recognizes most of his customers. Lately, though, he says it's been a lot of unfamiliar faces, and there could be any number of reasons for that. For one, due to lockdown orders, people who live in rural areas like Winchester aren't traveling as much into urban areas for work and are likely choosing to shop closer to home. Robin Lyons would usually shop at the Kroger 20 miles away, but now frequents Gray Scott.
This is the time because these are our neighbors and our fellow townspeople, and so we got to shop local.
The appeal of smaller grocery stores might also be driving city dwellers into more rural areas, says Shannon McCord, who owns Ideal Market in Superior, Nebraska.
Of course, Walmarts are always packed with people.
He says that makes it hard for customers to socially distance.
So I think they decide to stay local, which what it ended up doing is causing my store to be packed with people.
He says he's seen a 20 to 30% increase in sales since the start of the pandemic. Business is so busy, in fact, that he's completely burnt out.
It's been tremendously difficult. I've been putting in super long hours.
McCord says he's been working 70 or 80 hours a week, mostly on inventory.
I've been doing that for 10 weeks straight.
Supply chain disruptions have made it hard to keep items like meat, flour, and toilet paper in stock. But in many cases, smaller grocery stores have found workarounds by turning to their local communities. After meatpacking plant closures, for example, McCord started working to pair area hog farmers with local butchers in hopes of keeping his meat case stocked. And at Great Scott Community Market in Illinois, it was flour that was in short supply.
We're a small grocery store, and we're absolutely at the bottom of the supply chain. You know, we'll be the last ones to get something if it's scarce.
So Coonrod decided to buy and repackage flour from local restaurants so he could sell it off his own shelves. Ryle Carver with Kansas State University's Rural Grocery Initiative says this is a good example of how these stores can adapt in difficult situations. According to Carver, more than 20% of rural grocery stores in Kansas closed between 2008 and 2018. When one closes, she says it can hit a community hard.
And often the folks that are hit the hardest are the older adults in the community and the lower income individuals in the community who may not have the means or the capacity to get to a further away grocery store.
As stay-at-home orders begin to loosen, rural grocery store owners hope their new customers will continue to shop local. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
Some of the biggest outbreaks of COVID-19 have been concentrated in urban areas like New York City and Chicago. But rural America is not immune to the disease, and many small hospitals have been learning how to deal with it. Steph Whiteside of Side Effects Public Media has this report.
Farrell Hospital in the southern Illinois town of El Dorado is bracing for coronavirus. Dr. Joseph Jackson says it's inevitable the virus will spread to rural areas.
And so we've done our best to continue to stockpile PPE, ensure that we do have appropriate training on ventilators, and try to ensure that all equipment is ready to go.
El Dorado has a population of just under 4,000 people, and Farrell has only 25 beds. But the hospital doesn't just serve the town.
At first glance, when you look at who we serve, it's such a wide area and a little less dense in terms of population. But when those numbers start to come together, you know, there is quite a few people who depend on us.
When you factor in surrounding areas, Farrell actually serves around 50,000 people in four counties. The hospital doesn't have any ICU beds and only has 5 ventilators. It's a critical access hospital designed to stabilize patients and then transfer them. Jerry Cruz, dean of Southern Illinois University School of Medicine, says a pandemic is a unique challenge for already underserved rural areas.
Well, critical access hospitals, by their federal definition, can only have a small number of beds and can't do high-level ICU care. The ventilators they have are, you know, solely for instant emergencies and some ventilators that are related to some surgical cases. So they're not equipped normally for emergencies like this pandemic.
Pat Scow is director of the Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network. She says these rural hospitals face the same supply shortages that all medical providers are dealing with, making it difficult to build a reserve of protective equipment.
Right now, we're low in disposable gowns, you know, very hard to get disposable gowns. Some areas have a few more than others. You know, the price of a gown is going from 22 cents to almost $20 for a disposable gown, you know.
Jackson and Cruz say rural areas have advantages when it comes to social distancing. Populations are less dense, and most people drive rather than rely on public transit. Still, Jackson worries about what will happen if larger hospitals are overwhelmed and Farrell can't transfer patients who need high levels of care.
You know, these critical access hospitals, we're not used to taking care of critically ill patients for long periods of time, and that we may need to look to keep them more in-house, stabilize them, and treat them to the best of our abilities.
Cruz suggests hospitals should consider alternative arrangements.
And then you would think about scenarios such as how can you equip the rural hospitals to handle that level of care, or can some of the patients in the larger hospitals be transferred to the critical access hospitals so the larger hospitals can convert more of their beds to ICU beds and beds with ventilator capability.
Meanwhile, Jackson says the staff at Farrell has been focused on making sure they're up to date with training and the latest information about COVID-19. So far, Scow says critical access hospitals in Illinois have not had to deal with an overwhelming number of patients.
You know, we're seeing that they have 3-4 patients, you know. We haven't seen 10 or 15, but we have seen where their numbers are not just one patient. They might have 4 or 5. We have not had any that we've had to put in an intensive care.
Since our interview, the area served by Farrell has had 11 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
As unemployment has skyrocketed in recent weeks due to the pandemic, we're finally starting to see some businesses being allowed to open back up. But there is another problem. Will there be enough workers going back to their jobs? Jacob Barker is a business reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He wrote about the issue, and he joins us now. And Jacob, thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of people on unemployment, businesses seem to be having some trouble getting people to come back to work. What is going on?
Well, I mean, there's a couple issues. Many workers are scared, understandably, of the health risks of going back to work and interacting with the public and coworkers. I've heard, you know, particularly from like restaurant servers who are concerned about going back. And then the other issue I've heard from business owners, particularly who, you know, maybe have lower wage employees in like service sector, fast food restaurants, who say they are having trouble getting their employees to come back because unemployment benefits are very generous now with $600 a week from the Federal CARES Act passed at the end of March, tacked on to whatever the state payment is. So in Missouri, that's, you know, it's about $320 a week from the state unemployment insurance program, plus $600 from the federal unemployment, which, you know, gets up to $920 a week, which is about, you know, equal to $47,000 a year if you spread that out over the year. In Illinois, it's I think it's a little higher than $320 a week from the state, not a ton higher, but still, it's, you know, quite a bit of money. And for people who are working in lower wage jobs, it can be more than they were making before.
Now, is it legal, Jacob, for people to refuse to go back to work and instead draw unemployment, or is there something there that people are trying to work the system a bit?
Well, see, that's the big issue that employees and employers are in. Though Missouri kind of reopened towards the beginning of the month, St. Louis County just reopened last week. And, you know, I talked to workers who were in this conundrum of, they were worried about going back to work, but if they refuse when their employer calls them back, they are no longer eligible for unemployment insurance. And in the state of Missouri, actually, the state appears to be, you know, trying to remove as many people as possible from the unemployment rolls by making like a new portal for employers to report people who don't go back to work. And that makes sense because the state is paying basically out of a trust fund, as all states do. Unemployment benefits, at least their share, that's not the $600 federal share. Back in the last recession, those trust funds ran out and states had to borrow from the federal government.
Well, Jacob, you mentioned you cover both Missouri and Illinois, based in St. Louis. Is there some difference that may make this situation, you know, turn out differently in the state of Illinois compared to what you've already seen in Missouri?
Well, it depends how much Illinois wants to, I guess, enforce people refusing calls back to work from employers. Missouri has a Republican governor, and they have this new portal for people to report unemployment insurance. You know, nationally, the $600 federal benefit, that's become kind of a big issue for Republicans in Congress, saying it's too generous and it's disincentivizing people to go to work. So it kind of depends what policy ends up being, you know. But I've heard from employers too, who, you know, they don't want to report their workers, you know, who are worried about going back to work. They don't want to necessarily report them to the state and kick them off of unemployment. A lot of businesses are also in this conundrum because they've taken Paycheck Protection Loans, the federal program that was part of the CARES Act. And in order to qualify for full loan forgiveness, you have to bring your payrolls back up to what they were pre-crisis, pre-shutdown. And if you can't get your employees to come back to work on the payroll, you can document that they've refused an offer to return to work. And if you do that, the SBA will still count it and give you full loan forgiveness. So I've talked to business owners who say, you know, they are kind of, you know, in between a rock and a hard place. They don't want to be the bad guy and report workers who don't return to work and kick them off of unemployment. But at the same time, they're trying to stay in business and they want, you know, those Paycheck Protection Loans forgiven as much as possible.
Jacob, in Illinois, we've been much more restrictive on businesses during the pandemic. I think people here have looked at states like Missouri. Overall, the state has been much more open. You know, people in Illinois thinking that, oh, they're going to see a ton more COVID-19 cases and have a lot more problems because of that. Has that proven to be the case at this point?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I guess only time will tell. Like I said, you know, St. Louis and St. Louis County, the bulk of the St. Louis region with, you know, 1.3 million people, they only opened last week. And so they've kind of been an island along with Kansas City on the other side of the state as Missouri reopened towards the beginning of May. Everybody knows it takes a couple of weeks for symptoms to show up many times. So I guess we will see. In the St. Louis area, it's kind of interesting because, as you're aware, you know, Madison County kind of staged a bit of a protest against Governor Pritzker and tried to override them and say businesses can reopen. That's, you know, one of three major counties in the Metro East in the St. Louis area. And it's kind of left only St. Clair County, where East St. Louis and Belleville are in the St. Louis area, is pretty much the only county that still, you know, has really stringent, you know, stay-home lockdown requirements per Illinois' order.
Since bars and restaurants reopened in St. Louis, I know it's only been a few days, but have the crowds come back?
I wouldn't say crowds. Me and my wife are still doing curbside delivery. We haven't gone to a restaurant yet, but, you know, walking through the neighborhood, seems like some of the area bars that were closed, bars and restaurants that were closed are back open. Seems like mostly people are sitting outside on patios, keeping their distance here in the city of St. Louis. Not too many crowds, I would say. And it seems like business is returning, but slowly volume is definitely down from what I can see in my neighborhood.
Jacob Barker is a business reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He talked with us here on Statewide. And Jacob, thanks once again for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is Statewide. Just ahead, self-administered tests for COVID-19. Is that the answer to controlling the pandemic? Stay with us. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear from a county sheriff about some of the decisions he's had to make during the pandemic. That story is on the way. As COVID-19 testing becomes more available and crucial to reopening society, many hospitals are starting to offer tests where patients collect the samples themselves. It's a method that may become more common as federal guidelines expand to allow at-home testing. But it's raising questions from people concerned if those tests are accurate. Kate McGee explains.
In early May, Perry, who lives in the northwest suburbs and asked that we didn't use his last name to protect his privacy, started feeling symptoms that could be COVID-19. The 64-year-old and his wife drove to Waukegan to get tested. Instead of the super invasive and unpleasant test he'd heard about, he and his wife were told to stay in the car and were handed what looked like Q-tips.
They instructed us to take the swab and place it halfway up our nostril, twirl it to the right a few times, and then twirl it to the left a few times, and then let it sit in your nasal cavity for 15 seconds.
Then they handed Perry a small vial with liquid to put the swab inside, and they left the testing site. When Perry told his doctor about how he took the test, his physician said he was surprised he collected the sample himself.
And that my results were worthless based on his experience and his knowledge of how the test should be done.
Perry and his wife tested negative, but they didn't know if they could trust the results and decided to self-quarantine for 14 days. His experience raises two questions. Did the nasal swab go far enough to get a good sample? And should he be gathering the sample himself? Let's start with self-sampling. Healthcare experts say if it's done correctly, it's completely acceptable for someone to gather their own sample. Emily Landon is an infectious disease specialist at the University of Chicago. She and her team had conducted previous studies that show people can reliably test themselves. She says self-testing will likely become more common.
The holy grail of testing is really something where people can test themselves on a regular basis, and you don't need staff or people to wear PPE to do the collecting. You don't need them to be there. If you could just hand people a sample or they could pick up a kit and then take it home.
When there's a new virus, Landon says guidelines always start out especially conservative. For example, doctors testing for COVID-19 used to collect multiple nose and throat swabs, but also blood and urine samples. As doctors learned more, that changed. They've since dropped the blood and urine samples. Now federal guidelines allow for self-sampling and even at-home tests.
It's an acknowledgement that there are practicalities and that we may not need the redundancy that we were having before because now we're confident that this one method is good enough.
Then there's the question about the best way to get a sample. Does the swab need to go all the way to the back of the nose? An early study out of Washington State found self-collected nasal swabs, even those that don't feel like a brain scrape, can be just as reliable as those super uncomfortable tests administered by healthcare workers. Landon says UChicago and hospitals across the country are finding the same thing, but the sample still needs to be collected correctly.
If you skimp and you do just sort of just stick the cotton tip in as far as is comfortable, you're not going to get a good sample. It's going to have to be a little bit uncomfortable. That's what it comes down to.
Researchers say it may even be safer for healthcare workers if people collect their own sample. Experts say no matter the type of test and who is collecting the sample, no test will be perfect 100% of the time. So if you doubt your results or are worried you didn't collect a good sample, experts say to reach out to testing sites or a specialist who can advise you on whether you should retake the test. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
The coronavirus was in the forefront and in the background during the abbreviated spring legislative session that Illinois lawmakers wrapped up last weekend. And as Bill Wheelhouse reports, it was the focus of legislation and politics.
The pandemic destroyed the state's economy and, in turn, government spending. Governor J.B. Pritzker.
But this virus has blasted a hole through estimated incoming revenues for not just Illinois, but for the 50 states across the nation.
The legislature, in turn, will give Pritzker more authority in moving money within the state budget. The entire budget is reliant on the federal government. The state will borrow up to $5 billion from the feds to prop up the spending plan and to account for assistance all over the place for COVID relief.
In a moment, when our workers are and our businesses are struggling to get back on track, we have to ensure that our governments are there to back them up.
When the legislature started the session last Wednesday, there were protests outside the Bank of Springfield Center by people unhappy with the governor's stay-at-home restrictions. The protesters marched from the center where the House was meeting, a few blocks to the Capitol where senators met. Separate locations were due to the need for social distancing. One downstate lawmaker was kicked out of the House the first day for failing to wear a protective mask, but when the protesters left town for the most part, he returned wearing one. And a lot of the legislation highlighted COVID with plans to direct money to communities outside Chicago. Republican Ryan Spain wants to see relief coming to frontline workers in his Peoria area district.
To make sure that we can accommodate as many COVID expenses as possible for those units of government and retain important public safety jobs in those communities is critical.
COVID was also given as a main justification for an expanded vote-by-mail program. Evergreen Park Democrat Kelly Burke sponsored that.
We're trying to assist in keeping the public health impacts of COVID low or lower than they would be if people were all gathering in person at polling places to vote. So
COVID was the reason lawmakers say they passed a bill to help struggling bars serve booze curbside. The pandemic spurred the political arguments, too, not just from protesters on the outside. West Suburban Republican lawmaker Deanne Masochi says the minority party was left out of any discussion on trying to get Illinois open sooner.
Now, if you think we need to chuck the people's rights that we currently protect by law because of COVID-19, don't hide it, don't run from it. Put it on the table and debate it.
The Democratic-controlled legislature stayed away from that debate. But members also avoided spelling out the authority for the governor to fine businesses who violated COVID health regulations. And when the House passed the spending plan, Democratic House Majority Leader Greg Harris said hundreds of millions of dollars will go to those affected by the disease.
To save people from foreclosure in their homes, to save people from eviction when they can't pay their rent, to assist people with mental health services, to put PPE into our nursing homes, and give enough hazard pay that their workers can show up.
Illinois lawmakers aren't scheduled back in session until the fall, after which time the state will know more about how the coronavirus is playing out and what additional damage it's caused. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
Many state parks were allowed to open in Illinois earlier this month. And starting this weekend, the remaining parks and other sites managed by the Illinois Department of Natural Resources will reopen to the public. Chase Cavanaugh has more.
At the beginning of May, IDNR opened certain state parks to the public in what it called a phased reopening. These facilities need to have certain amenities, specifically flushable toilets and hand-washing facilities with sinks. Park staff monitored visitors at these sites, and IDNR Director Colleen Callahan said the results were encouraging.
Lots of cars in parking lots, but I didn't see a lot of people, and that was good. It meant that they came, and then they scattered. They went to hike. They went to bike.
Starting May 29th, camping and concession services will be opened up at those sites. In addition, parks that were still closed will be reopened, with certain social distancing guidelines. Callahan says some of those pertain to group activities.
Making sure that when you use a restroom or a shower facility, that you're not standing in a line. You know, make sure that you're going with a family unit, those that you arrived with. The camping will also mean that as you arrived for that campsite, that that will be the group that you stay with. Your campfire will be your campfire.
She says others are more general in nature, and signs will be in place that will describe what to do. Callahan says she hopes the public can act as partners in these measures, even though they may strike people as atypical for a park visit.
It is unnatural for us to visit one of our parks with a mask quickly at hand. It is unnatural for us to stay 6 feet apart from each other. It is unnatural to make sure that you have a handheld or hand-sized sanitizer in your pocket in case you need it.
While a mask may not be necessary for individuals out on the trail, Callahan says having one when getting close to others could help prevent community spread. And having hand sanitizer can help people clean their hands when there isn't a readily available source of water. These guidelines will be monitored by park staff, Friends of the Park groups, and Illinois Conservation Police. Callahan says some areas within parks will remain closed due to social distancing requirements.
The indoor facilities, such as a visitor center or historic site that is indoors, will be closed. And also the shelters, because that's where people gathered.
And Callahan hopes the same partnership with visitors regarding COVID-19 measures can also be kept in mind when it comes to general safety.
And so we'll be doing that just as we always have done. And then ask again in this partnership to be mindful of not going in areas that are marked where you shouldn't go. Don't go on trails that are marked off. Don't go to a rock area that you say, that looks okay to me. It probably is all right. No, when in doubt, don't.
And then there are closures due to demand. Callahan says IDNR will continue to exercise its normal crowd control methods. These include limiting entry if there's a spike in visitors, or temporary closures due to weather-related events, such as flooding. This may affect openings at parks with high demand.
And Starved Rock is not immune to flooding. It's like a magnet because of its location in the Illinois River and the tributaries.
Callahan says there was one upside to the closure. It gave park staff the opportunity to carry out maintenance that wouldn't have been possible or as easy to do with regular crowds, such as repairing wear on old trails or clearing debris without disrupting visitor flow.
I believe that when people get back to visit their park, and we say welcome home and welcome back, they'll notice that we've been paying attention to the details of what maybe we weren't able to get done previously and had the time and the space and the capacity to get done.
IDNR will in turn post guidelines for visitors online and on signage at parks around Illinois. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
You're listening to Statewide. Support comes from AARP Illinois, providing information to help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. State and local leaders are making decisions every day about the pandemic, and some of those are met with praise, others with criticism. Peter Medlin talked with the Winnebago County Sheriff about the process behind those big decisions.
Recently, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker unveiled an executive order to keep businesses from opening before Illinois reached the next phase of reopening. Business owners could be charged with a misdemeanor for violating the stay-at-home order. Within hours of the announcement, reaction flooded in from residents, businesses, and lawmakers. Some applauded the decision as a way to ensure safety for essential workers, and others said the order was a step too far. Gary Caruana is the Winnebago County Sheriff. He was one of several sheriffs, along with the Illinois Sheriffs Association, to denounce the decision and say he wouldn't enforce it. Caruana also criticized the governor for saying he might withhold funding for communities that don't enforce the order.
This is not a law. An executive order sounds powerful, but when you really break it down and drill down on it, it's a policy.
Caruana says it's his job to enforce laws and the constitutions of Illinois and the United States, and that there's a difference between that and the governor's policy. By May 20th, Governor Pritzker withdrew his own executive order. But debate around COVID-19 response in America often splits down party lines. Caruana is a Republican, but stressed his decision on the executive order was not a political one.
I don't care what side of the fence the governor's on.
But Caruana says it can be frustrating to see Facebook or Twitter responses to his law enforcement decisions.
Sometimes people get mad and they get emotional and, you know, bam, right on social media, there I go and I don't support this or I don't support you and shame on you or whatever. It's like, well, hang on. Let me break this down and find out what really is your right and that you don't really want to give up.
Even with the executive order revoked, he says he's not telling people to defy the stay-at-home order.
Absolutely take care of yourself. And if you're uncomfortable being in a public situation, don't put yourself in that environment. You certainly have the right, again, as citizens of this country, and it's a great country, to do what you need to do to protect yourself.
He says his department communicates with local leaders, law enforcement counterparts across the state, as well as with the Illinois Sheriff's Association when making these types of decisions.
It's really not that hard. I know that it's not going to be the most popular. And, you know, again, if you want to do this job right, you're not looking at popularity. You're looking at doing the right thing.
There's no precedent for a health crisis like this, and widespread misinformation only magnifies uncertainty some residents already feel about reopening and the future of the virus. And it means many want to hold their elected officials more accountable during this time. That means someone like Caruana has to rely on experts and colleagues more than ever.
Still have to make sure that I follow the rules and regulations and the Constitution and laws. Sometimes I agree with them, sometimes I don't, but I still am committed to keep the community safe.
Although coronavirus creates unique issues for his department, Caruana says his decision-making process hasn't changed much during the pandemic.
You go from one challenge to the next to the next to the next, and that's just part of, again, being a leader. And, you know, are you ever going to make everybody happy? Absolutely not.
Making decisions that affect a county full of people's safety, especially in the middle of a public health crisis, can be stressful. And working in law enforcement, you don't have the luxury of completely unplugging when you get home from work.
Do I get phone calls at night or in the middle of the night or whatever? Absolutely. But that's part of the job. But is it making me tired? No.
To clear his head, like many, Caruana and his wife have taken up the new American pastime during the pandemic, walking. And his day-to-day workflow hasn't changed much either. Caruana and his officers still come into work every day. The department has distributed personal protective equipment to workers. Officers can wear masks in the building, but it's not mandatory. His staff has also had to put in extra safeguards at the Winnebago County Jail. And corrections officers have their temperatures taken every time they come into the facility.
And we're trying to only stay with violent crimes right now at this point to try to make sure that we're, you know, keeping the jail numbers down.
Caruana is on the hot seat during the COVID-19 crisis, like most leaders. And some may personally disagree with the sheriff's actions during the pandemic, but he says he hopes people know that those weighty decisions are made in the best interest of public safety. I'm Peter Medlin.
With the move toward outdoor seating at bars and restaurants and some offices reopening, the state's movie theaters, which have been shut down since March, say they want to welcome customers too. Right now, the earliest they could open their doors, according to the state's plan, would be June 26th. Chris Johnson is president of the Illinois chapter of the National Theater Owners Association. He says he'd like his industry to reopen sooner so cinemas don't miss important summer release dates. Johnson says his association has a plan to limit the number of moviegoers at one time and require face masks for all customers and employees. Governor J.B. Pritzker was asked about it this week, but stood firm on a late June reopening at the earliest. Meanwhile, two freshmen have filed a lawsuit claiming Illinois State University did not refund enough of their mandatory student fees after shifting to online-only classes because of COVID-19. The two are seeking class action status for their federal lawsuit. They argue ISU's partial student fee refund was woefully inadequate because campus was essentially closed to students for 9 of the semester's 16 weeks. The lawsuit is pending. There's more of Statewide on the way. Be sure to check out our website, statewideshow.com. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Even though political campaigning this year has been severely limited, it's still possible. In fact, very active. That's according to a consulting firm based in the Quad Cities. Herb Trix tells us more.
Founded in 1997, Victory Enterprises is a full-service Republican campaign consulting firm, according to CEO Brian Dumas. And they do everything from direct mail and polling to advertising and social media for local and national candidates and organizations across the country. In some ways, he thinks campaigning is still the same as ever.
You know, the economy, the U.S. economy, the state's economies have been, shuttered and businesses devastated with everything that's going on. So, campaigns or candidates who have a clear message of here's the step A, B, and C we're going to do to get the economy moving back again when it's safe to do so.
Victory Enterprises says the mail is still a good way to get people's attention and make up for the fact that candidates can't go door to door. But COVID-19 has also forced some changes.
Obviously, with stay-in-place orders and people asking, for social distancing, door-to-door isn't something campaigns or candidates can do right now. And so it's really shifted a lot of strategy to campaigns spending their dollars and their time digitally, where they can reach people on their phones or their computers while they're at home. So one of the great things you can do, and something that we do at Victory Enterprises, is you can take a list of likely voters and upload that inside Facebook and do a match. And then you can deliver targeted advertising directly just to people are likely to vote in the election you're running for. And so it's a very efficient way to spend your dollars.
Who would have thought just a few months ago that candidates would have to campaign from their living rooms and their homes? But it's possible. And he points to William McKinley as an example. He ran his campaign for president in 1896 from his front porch while his wife was sick at home. Advice from Victory for its clients also includes asking friends to make calls for them and spreading the word on social media about their candidacy and to keep on fundraising. The company also makes signs and banners, and he hopes soon his candidates will be able to put them up around their neighborhoods, cities, and districts.
Just like every other business or, individual or group in life, candidates and campaigns are trying to figure out what the new normal is. And for now, that's a heavy emphasis on delivering, their message via digital platforms. And I think, everyone's hopeful that they can get out and get back to more traditional campaigning if things can get turned around and the curve flattened. So we're all praying that's the case.
Right now, Dumas is focusing on the primary elections in June in Iowa and some other states.
I think people might be willing to trade a ton of political TV ads on their local news in exchange for a little normalcy.
I'm Herb Trix.
Managing the COVID-19 crisis will require information that guides decisions. The Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois has brought together experts to measure the impact of the pandemic and develop a roadmap for reopening. I talked with the Institute's director, Robin Fretwell Wilson, about this project.
So the effort was really trying to give a kind of way to think about the problem as it sifts down to the state and to the local level. And I think decision makers aren't going to have the kind of expertise at the ready that the governor and that IDPH has. And so they will be trying to manage a lot of information and making their own individualized decisions. So we're hoping to expand the kinds of considerations that are unfolding, where there'll be information about the economic impacts as well as the public health impacts, and give folks a way of thinking about some of the, quote, trade-offs.
It seems that a big problem with reopening the state is that you know, most parts of Illinois still lack enough testing for a real clear picture of the spread of the virus. So how can these decisions on reopening or partial reopening be made and people have confidence in those?
That is a really great question. I mean, one of the things that we note in the piece for Illinois Issues is that, you know, some national players peg the state at needing it like, you know, tens and tens of thousands of tests. And we are far under those numbers. That's increasing to the credit of the state. It's been, you know, doing gigantic lifts to get us to where we are now. But that's a very difficult question because some of these metrics, even for moving from phase two to phase three, which, you know, is breaking the state into four regions, they are keyed and pegged to how many people are COVID positive. And when we can't do tremendous amounts of tests, it's hard to know whether we even hit that metric. People are going to want to, they're going to need to have the confidence to come back into the public space. So the more tests that we can have, obviously, the more confidence they'll have about that.
And even then is, you know, from the research and from people you've talked to, it seems like that's going to take a while for people to have that confidence to say, yeah, I know that maybe officials are telling me it's okay to go back, but I'd prefer not to at this point. So it seems as though this could be a long haul to get folks back to a point of where they're comfortable going into restaurants and going back to work in some cases.
I think that's right. You know, the Institute of Government and Public Affairs has done a task force about the impact of COVID-19 on the state. We've also tried to build up some understanding that's not just coming from government officials themselves about, you know, what's the pulse of people in Illinois. So we created a pandemic stress indicator that I'm doing with a colleague named Brian Gaines. And basically, we're polling three sets of, quote, experts on public health, on vulnerable populations, and on the economy, to ask them questions about when do they think it's time to move, and if you relax restrictions, what does that look like, and how would that happen, and who should be the decision maker? And I think that kind of information coming from these panelists will be helpful to the state decision makers as it falls from the governor into the laps of you know, the cities and the counties. For them to have kind of that information, it'll give them maybe a way for them to see public confidence coming back, but also to build public confidence. You know, if the folks that are in touch with these questions and with vulnerable people are saying, yeah, it's time, you know, then I think the public can have a lot of confidence in that too.
I know also discussed in the report was to make sure that any harm, but also any benefits of policy decisions were shared as fairly as possible. Can you talk about that point about making sure that there's fairness in all of this?
Economists often talk about these problems as sort of trade-offs and trying to minimize the total harm or maximize net benefit. And one of the things that I think we forget when we look at minimizing or maximizing is that some people take it on the chin harder than others. And if we could have three decisions that are all going to maximize the same way, but one of them doesn't have a set of Illinoisans really taking the hit, then we should scratch the one, you know, that has a set of people taking the hit in favor of the other two.
That's going to require, I'm guessing, a real concerted effort from, you know, top down, from government, maybe even at the federal level, all the way to local officials and local leaders, local business leaders.
I think that's right. I think it does require all levels of government. And right now, we've had the federal government acting. We've had the Illinois governor acting and very responsibly to get us to where we are right now. But as this filters down, there will be immediate decisions that we're faced with that local authorities get to make their own calls on that I think sometimes can make something worse for an identifiable population or something better. So just a specific example, we, as a part of this larger task force, released a policy spotlight on the drop in child abuse and neglect reports to the hotline. That has happened, and it's been precipitous, as you know. We're like sitting at about 47% of the normal number of reports. Now, why is that? Well, because these kids have suddenly become unseen, right? They're not going to see their teachers every day. They're not seen by the school nurse. They're not seen by a school social worker. So what could you do with that? Well, you might get your firefighters out walking in the neighborhoods, just talking to kids, you know, to build up the number of eyes and ears. You know, it's almost a call to be creative, you know, to think about the people who are likely to have been disproportionately impacted, like children. And then think outside of the box. How can we, even with all the other constraints that we have, how can we do something constructive as to this specific vulnerable population?
Along with balancing the public health and the economic arguments, this has also become highly politicized. And what challenges does that bring?
So if I came to this pandemic vulnerable to the economic risk, let's say I drove an Uber, okay, I'm going to care deeply about getting that economy back online, right? Getting this reopening in place. And it's going to feel really personal. And, you know, if I'm an older person, like older than 60 or whatever, and I'm vulnerable to the virus, the public health risk is going to seem very, very existential to me. And I think what's difficult for the state and local decision makers is that every aspect of what they are trying to juggle and maximize, quote unquote, to use the economic term, is existential to someone. And I think we want, where we can, I think we're morally obliged to try to minimize the fallout for those people who started fragile. And I look at the document, which is not my document, it's something that I wrote, using the wisdom of this full council, you know, a whole set of people who have long been part of IGPA, the economists and new voices. But the wisdom of that council, I think, tells us that this is a hard problem. It's not insoluble. It doesn't have to defeat us. And we can find consensus, but I think we have to be completely candid and honest about some people coming to this problem more fragile than others, and that, you know, people face and are experiencing these risks differently depending on their vantage point, because it's going to crater their life.
And you mentioned that vantage point. I'm fortunate that I'm able to work and be paid during this. You're doing the same. Not everybody is that lucky.
I'm sitting at my second home right now, Sean. Mm-hmm. Okay. My father had like a third grade education and grew up in Appalachia, went into the military, changed the whole arc of his life. And a lot of my family still lives very, very modestly, like my dad, like his beginnings. Okay. My sister is so grateful to have a job at Walmart because Walmart doesn't close. But for that, if she still worked at the gas station that she worked at last year, this would have cratered her whole life. And she is as eager to get the world back on track and open as anybody, because she works in retail. And even Walmart, you know, if we get bludgeoned as an economy, even they're going to feel it. And she's one of the last people hired there. So she'll be one of the first people to go. It's very easy for me to, you know, as somebody at the university and, you know, as a faculty member, to kind of say, yeah, hey, let's focus on the public health risk. In other parts of my own family, those economic risks are really, really incredible. And I'll tell you, it terrifies me. My sister is living with my mother. Okay. My mother's 84 years old. And my sister's trying to hold on to a livelihood in the middle of this, but going home to my mom. And so we like talk all the time about, how are you washing your hands? Are you bringing this into the house with my mom, right? We're trying to manage that from a distance and talk about that. So, you know, even in my little tiny family, you have people who are gonna be laser focused on this risk very, very differently. Because of the vantage point that they sit at. And for the people who have modest lives, I think the economic risks are super scary. And that gets missed in a lot of what I read.
Robin Fretwell Wilson is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. You can read more about the task force of experts and the work being done to create a roadmap for safely reopening the economy. You can find that at statewideshow.com. That's all the time we have this week for Statewide. You can join us again next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. And again, our website, statewideshow.com. You can find this episode and any of our past shows there as well. Our podcast can be heard through the NPR One app. Statewide is brought to you by AARP Illinois, providing information that can help you and your family when the coronavirus continues to affect us all and keep us apart. More information at aarp.org/near you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.